Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 236. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me this week, James Jones.
Hello.
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
And John Lindemann.
What's up, party people?
Now, putting away my radio voice for just a moment, we have a fantastic show for you lined up. We've got a bunch of Wii games here, actually, some really interesting DS games, and that's all. Actually, on my docket right here, I don't show any non-Nintendo games for new business. How exciting is that? How unusual is that?
Don't get used to it, people. Don't get comfortable.
John's lining up Crysis 2 for the next month or something.
Then we're up for now playing with a lot of exciting 3DS content on the website and exciting features that look back at the history of video games.
Be fucking excited.
Finally, your listener mail with some really interesting topics and a follow-up on a question from last week. I will kick off new business this week. I've been playing Monster Hunter 3 Tri.
Yeah, everybody takes a try at it.
I am done playing Monster Hunter 3 Tri.
Perfect. How long did you get in? 4 hours?
No, I played it more than that. I took a couple stabs at the Great Jaggy, had a little bit different loadout the second time, and I finished a whole bunch of quests, and the game just didn't grab me. I have to say, I admit, I didn't play it online. We talked
about
it.
It'll bore you to death then, for sure.
We just didn't get around to it. I will say the game's really beautiful. I think probably the way it accomplishes that is by having very small environments that are all connected by little loading time corridors. So I'm not super impressed with how the environments are pieced together. I feel like the game would be more fun to play and would feel more seamless if you just moved from one area to the next, if the areas were more expansive and open. So I don't really like the idea of it being the sort of grid on the map that you constantly have to move from zone 1 to zone 2 to zone 3, because I feel like all the zones are pretty small. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's just going from one to the other, seeing, oh, are there any herbs over there? Did the big monster show up here, or is he going to be over there?
It's more like, oh, are there any? Oh, God, it's the giant Jaggy, run!
Yeah. Oh, and it called boss number 2, now I'm just dead.
I grew annoyed at the limitations on how many healing items you could carry, and the controls are definitely a problem for me. I've decided that, you know, if some people are graphic sluts and they only play games that are like really crazy good looking and, you know, they have to have the best computer so they can run everything at the highest settings and everything, I think I'm a control slut.
I don't want to hear that phrase
Graphics whore and controls whore, those are the terms I was thinking of. But yeah, I have a problem playing games that don't have very good controls.
I don't think you're alone in that statement.
Yeah, and especially with Monster Hunter. The controls aren't bad, they're just really awkward, and you can't really customize them.
Yeah. Well, the thing is with Monster Hunter Tri is the problem that I think most people are going to have with the game is that you have to adapt to the control scheme, not the other way around. Like,
right.
It's like either you like it or you don't.
I don't like it.
Yeah. Most people don't.
I gathered.
You know, I think I understand the controls. I just don't really care for them. Mm-hmm. The camera was a big issue for me, just that you constantly have to manage the camera.
Yeah.
And the camera moves kind of slowly, and it's just in an awkward place. The combat really wasn't that much fun to me, because it's based a lot on hit detection and being at the right angle and using the right move for that, and the animations are just kind of very slow. Mm-hmm. I used the sword and the shield, and then also the great sword. And yeah. In both cases, I felt like the animations are really canned, and it's a matter of, like, once I start this animation, how much am I going to get hit before it's over?
Yeah.
That's just the kind of frame counting and shit that I really don't think is very satisfying.
I mean, battle is much more tactical than you would think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a lot more of, I know he's, when he attacks, he's going to do this way. Like, he's going to run forward, and once he runs forward, he's not going to move left or right. So therefore, I will put myself here so he will miss me, and I will hit him as he goes by. Like, that's the way the battle works. It's just,
yeah,
you're right. It's very canned.
I get it. Yeah. No, I mean, I see what's going on with the battles and the way that you have to set up your moves and watch the enemy's animations and stuff. It's just not very fun to me. And that's kind of how I feel about the whole game. Like, I see where in the systems where the grind is built in and it's supposed to be addictive, and I understand how people could get addicted to collecting these items and combining them and forging upgrades to their stuff. But I think this game is, I think its chops as an RPG are sort of arguable, because your character doesn't really level up. I guess there's the cooking aspect, so you can get stat upgrades, but in this weird way of using cooking. And I found that the ability to upgrade your armor is sort of slow and very arduous and complicated, you know, in terms of gathering all this stuff. And, you know, I can deal with that in, say, Dragon Quest IX, where it gives you recipes and you have a pretty clear idea of what you need to get to do the next upgrade and where you might be able to get it. And all of that is sort of going on the side, but you're still leveling up in the primary sense as well. You know, just you get experience points. Your character's always growing and you're getting job points and stuff like that. And leveling up armor and you know, alchemizing your equipment is sort of on the side. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Monster Hunter, that's all there is. It's just loot.
Yeah.
Your character doesn't level up otherwise. Same with Torchlight. I mean, there's loot and you're going after new equipment, but you're also leveling up your character and getting new abilities. And that doesn't happen in Monster Hunter. It's just loot.
It's strictly a boss rush and a gear grind.
And also, there's not really a sense of exploration because, you know, you get out in these environments and they're really pretty, but also they give you a map and they show you where everything is. And you go there and there's not really anything to find there except like a chunk of ore over here that you can use your pickaxe on.
Well, I mean, the focus really is literally on the hunt.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's not always clear who is being hunted by who.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the game is just very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do feel like the game is not really balanced for the single player.
No.
It's balanced. It's almost expecting you to have multiple people there. And,
right.
And in order to play it single player, you'd have to grind a lot harder.
Yeah.
On the easy stuff, and you know.
Well, you can hire a cha-cha or whatever to help you, but
a cha-cha. Mm.
Yeah, that's what they're called. They're called cha-chas. I don't know.
I didn't get to that part.
That's awful.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a pet that can attack monsters with you, but they're pretty useless as well.
Mm. Good. Perfect. I was hoping to spend my money on useless things.
Yep.
The money that's incredibly difficult to get in this
Well,
game.
The problem is you can't really control them very well, right? So, you know, like
good.
Like say if you're playing like an MMO, you'll have a pet that you have like a full suite of controls, like. The cha-chas, they just, like, attack something automatically, so they, like, pull huge monsters towards you that you don't really want to attack, and it's just...
Good. So basically, they pick fights with things you shouldn't be fighting.
Exactly.
Perfect.
That's called aggro, isn't it?
No, aggro is when they do it on their own. This is something causing them to be mad at you. Hmm. This is like having a douchebag friend who just has to pick fight with the biggest guys in the room.
Well, it's called pulling. they inadvertently pull monsters.
Well, I'll say this. I went into Monster Hunter with... as open mind as possible because I, you know, that demo left a bad impression on me. And the real game definitely eases you into things much, much, much better than the demo, as you guys had promised.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I knew that all four of us have played it now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just, you know, I wanted to be part of the conversation. I wanted to know what everybody's
has been
pressure, talking
basically.
About. And I gave it probably 7+ hours, and if a game can't grab me in that amount of time, I'm not going to play it anymore. So I think that's more than fair. You know, I know the game does have kind of a high learning curve and takes a long time to sink its hooks into you, and I'm not that interested. I'm not going to devote twice that to see if maybe it works better that farther into it, you know. I respect the people who have, because clearly there are people who have played it for hundreds of hours, and I'm sure they put a lot of time into it in the beginning before it really connected with them, but I've just got other games I want to play, so I didn't bring it up to just bag on it. I just wanted to kind of report and just say, hey, this is not for everybody. Maybe that goes without saying, but
I'm pretty sure that was well established.
Yeah, maybe so, but you know, I did give it a shot, and I was kind of hoping I'd like it more than I ended up liking it, which is too bad. So the other game I play this week is for WiiWare. There was a demo put out on the Wii Shop channel for Dive, the Metis Island Secret. And it's a game that I was interested in when it first came out, but I think the review that went up at our site had some caveats in it, and I just wasn't sure if I wanted to pop $10 on it. I played the demo, and I was like, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. So I paid for the full thing, because the demo was... it didn't blow my mind or anything, but it was... pretty solid, and I was curious to see what else it had going for it. And Dive is sort of this 2D exploration. It's kind of like a 2D version of Endless Ocean. It's a little more action-based than that. It's not so much about touching fish or, you know, identifying species or anything. Most of the fish in the game are hostile. Fuck. It's not like you need to go out and kill all of them. Actually, you can't. You don't have enough ammo. The controls to attack really aren't that great. So for the most part, you just need to evade. You really only want to shoot an enemy if it's right in your path and you can't get around it otherwise. But for the most part, the dive is about exploration in these 2D oceanic environments. So it's about, you know, turning on your flashlight when you get deep, avoiding barnacles and sea urchins and stuff like that that could hurt you, that's on the walls, and you're looking for treasure. And that part's pretty fun, actually. And you collect treasure, it's worth money, and then you can go to the shop and upgrade your equipment, kind of like in Endless Ocean, although I think it's probably handled a little bit better here in Dive. And really, and the game is pretty long, too. I think I probably ended up playing it for like 7 or 8 hours before I finished it. And I feel like that's a pretty good value for a $10 WiiWare game. And the only problem is I kind of lost engagement with it after about the halfway point because I ran out of things to buy in the shop. And that was kind of exciting to be, you know, improving my abilities and having something to spend money on. And halfway through the game, I had bought everything, and so I don't have as much motivation to collect treasure anymore. And so I finished the game, but I wasn't as interested in like finding all the little knickknacks hidden all over the levels after that. I really just kind of found whatever I absolutely had to proceed, because there's not a whole lot of reason to find all that other stuff. And the game does become pretty difficult towards the end with just the number of jellyfish and sharks and things like that that are out there to get you. So I just found it was better to just kind of have a more of a focus on getting to the end of the level and finding the main treasure. But I would recommend Dive. It's definitely, you know, there was the early pre-release stuff. We thought maybe it's kind of like a Metroid game underwater, and that's not true. And I think the review on our site makes that pretty clear. There is an exploration element to it, but I think that's kind of where it stops. It is more like Endless Ocean. It's fairly relaxing for the most part. The music's very mellow and, you know, whatever. But I do like the game. I think it looks beautiful. Really, really good, especially for a WiiWare game. There's a nice amount of variety, and even though it's a 2D game, the backgrounds have this sense of depth to them that's really nice, and sometimes you get into some more of the special areas, the hidden areas, and the backgrounds are really beautiful. There's like crazy ruins and stuff going on back there, and they look great. And the lighting's very good, too. So, I would recommend Dive, but it's not like the most amazing thing ever, but it's good. Definitely check out the demo since it's out there now. All right, John, you're up next.
I've been playing some more Pokemon. Of course, Pokemon it'll be going on in the background for years and years, I'm sure.
No, it won't.
Just like Chrono Trigger.
I'm not
John's gonna... playing Chrono Trigger in real time.
Yeah.
By the 24th century, we should be.
one day I will come to this podcast and say I beat Chrono Trigger. And
I'm not counting on still being alive at that point, John. So
no, I can't.
Whatever.
I can't wait.
It might be worth pointing out for what perhaps few listeners we have that are not intimately familiar with Chrono Trigger that it is relatively short for a Square JRPG.
Especially for that era. I mean,
it's like 15 hours probably, first time through.
It depends how you approach it.
I can beat it in like 10.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's like your first playthrough, you're going to go longer than that.
Yeah. Anyway, the reason I brought it up, John, is I thought it was interesting that you've now had Pokemon for 2 or 3 weeks, and I bet you've already played more of it than you have of Chrono Trigger. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think it is about Pokemon that keeps you coming back and keeps you wanting to play more?
It's briskly paced. Mm-hmm. And it's you. And the thing is, I know I've heard other people that have played a lot more Pokemon than me, like Obi, for instance. He said that the towns, they aren't, like in other Pokemon games, they're quite spaced out. So, you know, you have a lot of kind of, you know, running around before you kind of get to the next chapter of the game. But Pokemon Black and White, the towns are very close. So you're always constantly moving. And also the fact that there isn't really much to figure out in Pokemon. Like there's nothing, like I find with Chrono Trigger, there's some parts of the game where, like where I've kind of gotten off track with it is areas where I'm just kind of like, okay, where the heck do I go now? If I put it down for like a couple of days.
A couple.
Years.
Well, I mean, one thing I heard, which I thought was an interesting substantive difference in the structure of the new Pokemon games, is that any situation we had in HM, you needed to progress through the environment, like cut or Rock Smash or something like that. That stuff is still in the game, but it's not anything that you absolutely have to do to just get through like the progression of the gyms.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. It makes sense that Unova is which is the region in this game, is quick to get through because, I mean, it's based on New York by itself. And if you look at the map in the game of the world, it's just a tiny little space.
Yeah. Is it the five boroughs?
Kinda. I
That's cool.
The big city is clearly Lower Manhattan.
Huh. Okay.
There's a few things in there that are kind of in there. But, like, there's a map of the world, and Unova is just a little peninsula on a larger continent versus the other games where you're basically doing the whole freaking continent.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the main thing. It's just the fact that, I mean, in Chrono Trigger, there's just certain areas where...
Defend your gameplay habits.
I get bogged down, and I just don't feel like sitting there and going to, like, you know, Game Facts and figuring it out. And that's pretty much it. And so I just put it down.
John, you can call me anytime, and I'll tell you the minimal amount you need to know to get through.
I would never lower myself to that, Johnny. I would never give you the...
No, I'm offering my services because I won't spoil the game for you and I won't tell you the next five things. I'll just tell you, you tell me exactly where you're stuck, which I don't know. Chrono Trigger doesn't seem like the kind of game where you could get stuck, but it's hard for me to have a perspective on that because I played it so many times so long ago.
It's very directed, but the problem is that if you take big breaks in between playing, some of those directions are not going to be...
I could see that.
...are not going to be in your mind anymore. Like, you might just have, you know, in game terms, you might just have spoken to someone who gave you some information that would lead you to the next thing that opens up the sequence. But if real time, that's been months, then, you know, you're going to be at a loss. So if you're playing it in a relatively continuous stream, I think it's pretty brisk and straightforward compared to some RPGs.
Well, that's what I liked about Dragon Quest IX is the fact that, you know, you can press, I think you press Y and it's like...
The recap stuff.
Yeah, it recaps, so you know exactly
where to go next.
I mean, that's kind of a neat thing that goes on in Radiant Historia. Not only do you get the recap, but you actually have... If you have a directive right now, in the pause menu, it tells you what the hell you're supposed to be doing.
That's a more modern thing, but it's nice.
Yeah, that's probably my main thing. And, you know, of course, most games aren't, like, especially RPGs, they aren't designed with the person that takes months breaks from the game in mind.
No, right. They're designed for me, the person who plays them in 3 days.
But, and also with Pokemon 2, you know, even though they don't have that kind of, you know, the whole, like, recap sort of thing in there, it's very easy to just kind of walk around wherever you are and sort of figure out what you're doing. Because you're really not doing anything different other than finding the next gym. I mean, you know, and catching Pokemon around you. I mean, there's really not much else to do in that game.
I think one thing I'd really like to change in Pokemon, and I know this is heresy for the devoted fans, but I wish the hidden machines... I really am not a fan of the way those are implemented. I wish they didn't take up slots in your creature's inventory. I wish that you didn't have to manually use them on monsters. Because as it is, a lot of times when I play Pokemon, which is like every few years, I find that once I get into, you know, areas where I need a lot of HMs, I look for a monster that's like compatible with three of them at a time, maybe.
Yes.
Like a flying water insect.
The Swiss Army knife Pokemon.
Yeah, and that's pretty normal, is to have one in your party that's... It's just an HM slave.
I think that says a lot for how messed up that whole mechanic is.
Yeah, it essentially reduces your party to five.
Yeah,
yeah,
but I mean,
but
you can swap them out when you actually are going into battle. I mean,
oh yeah, but in those, you know, you'll always, like, if you're in a cave or something, you'll be carrying
it's
Pokemon.
It's to force you to put some consideration when you start doing this stuff.
Well, and also the thing is, the moves like Cut, it's pretty good as a battle ability when you first get it, and the same with Surf and Fly. But later on in the game, those really aren't very competitive abilities.
Fly is always useful because it's a two-turn move, which means you're impervious to damage during this first turn.
Yeah,
yeah, Cut's kind of crappy usually.
I feel like the HMs don't need to be battle abilities. They could be auxiliary abilities that, you know, if your monster is capable of learning it, it just knows it. How about this? Your HM automatically teaches that move to any monster that in your collection that is capable of learning it, but it's not used in battle and it doesn't take up a space.
Yeah.
That would be so much... I mean, just that streamlining. And I think maybe the reason they don't do it is because it has to be compatible with all the old monsters that already learned Fly. And also, can we get some different HMs, please? Does it have to be the same five in every game?
They did add one. I thought they did add one in one of the later games.
I'm not saying they need to add them. I'm saying they could just give different ones. They don't have to use the same ones every time.
I think it's a nice compromise to make those less essential to just progressing through the core story and the, you know, the gym progression. And there still must be plenty of that in terms of, you know, finding secret areas, like where there'd be better items and, you know, maybe special Pokemon or whatever.
Well, in the previous games, they also served as a bulwark to make sure that you couldn't start jumping through the fucking game by...
Yeah, sequence breaking kind of stuff.
Yeah, like you had to... You couldn't use it until you had a specific badge, so you couldn't jump straight to, like, the third badge from the starting town.
There's plenty of other ways to do that that are probably less irritating. Yeah, I know. It's,
and there's multiple ways they do it in the game, too, actually. There's a few gates they put in your way.
Well, isn't it fair to say that Black and White are currently the ultimate Pokemon games, in which you, through various machinations, can have every single monster ever made?
Before Black and White came out, until Gold and Silver was out, it was impossible to get Heart Gold, Soul Silver. It was impossible to have them all.
Mm-hmm. Now you can catch them all on DS. I just feel like, you know, with 3DS, there's not a really clear way to transfer your DS monsters to whatever the new Pokemon for 3DS will end up being. You'd have to have multiple systems and do it wirelessly. I just feel like, is this finally the opportunity to just reset everything?
Nope.
And say, you can't use your old monsters, we're not going to deal with that. It finally lets us break out of these design shackles of backwards compatibility.
That's not going to happen.
Never.
Just completely redo the whole thing.
It's selling better than ever. Did it set records for like a million in a day North America?
See, here's the thing. Now you can trade online, and I assume you'll be able to backwards trade online with the 3DS version, which means you can do trades as long as you're not trading something that didn't exist in the previous game.
You'll
be able to trade with them.
What if they made all the old monsters from all the previous games up through Black and White? What if they turn those into like statues like you have in Street Fighter? So they kind of do these mini battles or something, but that the main creatures that are in the game are new.
Well, I mean, they did have, again, it was sort of a compromise whereby with Black and White, you only encounter the new guys for, like, the main body of the game.
Which
and then
people are complaining about, apparently. I think that's the best thing about it.
But no, I actually don't find that to be particularly appealing. But that happened in Diamond and Pearl as well, to a lesser extent.
It wasn't hard to get Pikachu in Diamond and Pearl.
The vast majority of existing Pokemon you could not get if you had the National Dex. And in fact, that was kind of an issue with that game because they didn't add a lot of fire types in the Diamond and Pearl generation. And one set was exclusive to Pearl, which meant there were like three fire types in the whole effing game for Diamond. And they all sucked.
Welcome to Inside Pokemon.
I'm glad we're getting into the nitty-gritty Pokemon because I feel like we actually rarely do that. Considering how popular the game is and how, you know, how many people play it.
Well, considering how much I know about the series, unfortunately, that's...
Yeah. Tell me about your EVs.
I actually don't EV train because EV training is completely asinine.
It's insane.
It's insane that people have figured out how it works. I mean...
Yeah, I know.
It's not like there's anywhere in the game that tells you how the fucking thing works.
Well, John, why don't you tell us about the other game you've been playing?
All right, the other game I've been playing, I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm somewhat of a fan of the sweet science of pro wrestling.
I knew, you know, Rick Powers is way into it, but I didn't know that you had an interest.
Not recent wrestling, but, you know, kind of
retro 80s wrestling.
And,
of course.
Yeah, 80s and 90s.
All you had to do is meet John and know that he would be into 80s wrestling.
Yeah.
I could talk 90s wrestling with you, like do some WCW, some NWO.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. It's good stuff.
That was my maturation period. That was me being 15, 16 and thinking wrestling was cool for like 2 years.
That was a golden era, my friend.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. Nothing about wrestling was ever a golden era.
James. Heresy. On Virtual Console this week, they released Natsume Championship Wrestling.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, so it piqued my interest. You know, I tend to enjoy wrestling games, at least have in the past. And Natsume, you know, is kind of one of those underground devs who, you know, I've always kind of...
They're not that underground.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess with Harvest Moon and all that, but, you know, I don't really... I never really think of them as Harvest Moon. I was actually...
I think of Lufia.
Well, they published Lufia.
Lufia, Scat, one of the best named games ever.
Scat.
They've also done Rune Factory and Shadow of the Ninja. So, you know, they've always been very competent, so I figured...
Also, Pocky
I wouldn't
Rocky.
Go that far.
Pocky.
They have occasionally
Rocky.
Been very competent.
Not, okay, they haven't been terrible. Let me put it that way.
Tell us about this wrestling game, John.
Natsume Championship Wrestling. Yeah, it's kind of stripped down. It only has 12 wrestlers in it, and I don't know if this was... they're all very, very generic, and I think typically from this time period...
Stereotypes?
Japanese kind of wrestling stereotypes, although nobody has a mask or anything like that. There's no like great kabuki sort of thing with like face paint.
It's not Fire Pro Wrestling.
Well, yeah, Fire Pro Wrestling. I mean, typically games from this era, they all have like the Hulk Hogan character.
And the era is Super Nintendo, right?
Yeah, this is Super Nintendo. This game's actually from 94. So I kind of expected, even in Japan, like I expected sort of like a Hulk Hogan character, maybe an Andre the Giant character, something like that. Like any of those American wrestlers that were big in Japan, I figured that there would be something in there. But there's really no one like that in there. And they're just completely generic Japanese-ish wrestlers with names like Python, Big Ape, and Asteroid. Like they're terrible names.
So drop from the sky.
Yeah, and it smashes to the earth with great force. But yeah, so it's really a much more kind of stripped down package than I expected. You know, you have single and tag matches. You can, you know, play through a tournament. The weirdest thing is that, you know, you can have like a practice match. So I figured, hey, you know, just to learn the controls of the game, I figured I would, you know, just play a practice match against the computer. You can't do it. You can only have 2- and 4-player practice.
Practice this.
You have to play through the tournament. It's just really weird. And then the actual gameplay, it's pretty basic, but kind of hard. It's hard to learn because, you know, you can do your punches and kicks, but the way you actually lock up with somebody, you just, the two characters, they'll kind of grapple when they come near each other. So it becomes a game of timing, I think, where, you know, you kind of, and I'm not too sure if it's based on your character's health or what, but pretty much you come close to each other, you lock up, and then you do a move like, you know, up in A or like down in Y or something. And I'm not too sure what determines how your move, like how you win over your opponent, but I just found the timing very, very hard to predict. And it was just very, generally I got my ass kicked a lot, even though I thought I was like executing moves correctly. It's very, 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 very hard to learn. And it just seems like it would be very hard to come back once you're getting beat up, because I'm pretty sure that whoever wins the grapple is probably based on the character's health. I mean, it can't be random. You know, makes no sense.
It's not button mashing?
I don't think so. There's nothing in the control in the manual that indicates button mashing. But yeah, I mean, if you're a wrestling fan, I wouldn't recommend it. I couldn't think of any other wrestling games that are actually on Virtual Console, though.
What up with Pro Wrestling for NES? That's a Nintendo game.
Yeah.
Was it Mr. Slender?
Yeah.
Mr. Slender? What is
the, like,
the
Great
Panther?
Is it potentially racist now?
It might be.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I don't think so. Pro wrestling has, you know, a lot of people have good memories of that. I mean, it's really simple.
Yeah.
But it's fun, and it was a good 2-player game for NES, for sure.
Yeah, I was wondering if any of those N64 Aki wrestling games are
out. No, because they're third party. They all use the controller pack as this.
Yeah.
And that, I guarantee, and THQ still owns the license.
Yeah.
So,
well, the thing is, now they have Yuke's making all those games now.
Yeah, but if THQ could release like WCW Revenge or WWE...
No Mercy?
No Mercy.
Yeah.
They would make a lot of money on Virtual Console.
Yeah, those games are amazing.
They are really fun. I love those games when I was a teenager.
Yeah, they're by far the best wrestling games I've ever played.
Yeah.
I mean, all of them.
They're better than the ones coming out now.
Yeah. It's actually interesting because I was wondering just kind of like what happened with those Aki games and, you know, what the story was behind them. And Aki, actually, they made those wrestling games up to No Mercy.
And that was the last one.
Yeah, that was the last one. And they actually were planning a sequel to that, but it somehow got lost in development hell. THQ took it away from Aki and gave it to Natsume, who were making the wrestling games for THQ at that time for the Game Boy Color.
Yeah.
And then that game just got canceled. And Aki has never made a wrestling game since. They actually did. They made Def Jam Vendetta.
Yeah, that's a real shame. And again, it's just like, come on. I mean, if we could just get the controller pack emulated for N64, it's just the dumbest feature to be a roadblock here, because it opens the door. And I know people are like, who wants to play third-party games on N64? No Mercy, right there.
Those mm-hmm. were a big deal. I never played any of the wrestling games on N64, but if a lot of people that have fond memories of the N64 in Western markets, it's to do with those wrestling games.
It's kind of the precursor to Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
I know that sounds weird, but a lot of it is, you know, trying to throw the guy out of the ring, doing a hold on him, or there was a lot of special moves, it's a lot of grappling.
Yeah.
It's very fast-paced and easy to understand and very colorful. And it's a great multiplayer, it's a great four-player game.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do think that Smash Brothers kind of stepped up to the plate and took over late in the N64 when those games had sort of stopped coming out. But
Well, the thing is that those games, the controls are so intuitive.
Yeah. Oh, they're very simple controls.
Yeah, they're just layers of controls. And so, like, they don't focus so much on mapping button combos to particular moves.
It's just like up, down, left, right once you grapple. It's, again, very much like Smash Brothers.
Yeah, so it's really fun to just sit there and, you know, pick a character, and you really don't know what moves are mapped to what, but you're free to just sit there and experiment and see what they do. And mm-hmm. you can also create your own characters and map moves. It's just, it was excellent. Those games are fantastic.
Yeah, they're really fun. Well, what a shame. James?
So, I impulse bought on Thursday during our last recording a copy of Touch Detective 2.5.
During a discussion of impulse purchasing.
Yes, which led to an act of impulse purchasing. Yeah. Go figure. I bought it online. It was late, too, so it was late Thursday night.
And, of course, you were drunk.
No, I wasn't drunk. I was on the show. I wasn't the one who was on the show drunk last week. Thank you very much.
Evan and I started out drunk and became progressively more sober as the show went on, which you can hear pretty easily in the recording.
James will certainly sober you up over time.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. But it actually showed up on Saturday, which is pretty impressive turnaround, since I ordered it late Thursday night. And I have since blasted through the entire game. If you don't know what Touch Detective is, it's basically an adventure game, an old school adventure game, point and click. And she's like a young teenage girl who is also a detective. And she solves completely whacked out mysteries in a world that makes no effing sense.
Is there very much substantial difference? You spoke about this, I think it was just around the turn of the year, the first one. Is there any substantial differences?
Mechanically, there's essentially no differences between the two games. I mean, it's straight up level pack.
But this one's 2.5.
It's 2.5. So it would probably be better called Touch Detective 1.5. But
do you have any sense of why they went with that? Why was it just to be weird?
Just to be weird.
To evoke Naked Gun, as we discussed last week.
I mean, there's a lot of things in this game that are just to be weird. So it wouldn't surprise me if it was just their desire to be strange that led to this game being called 2.5. Hmm. The missions, though, the mysteries, as they refer to them, are actually a lot better than the ones in the first game. There's a lot less just completely random bullshit tapping to find what the answer is. And there's a lot more consistency in the overall story. As opposed to the first game where, generally speaking, the villain of the story would essentially be let off with a stern warning at the end and then would proceed to rejoin communal...
Is that the 60s Batman female villain thing? Oh, you poor disturbed girl. It's all right. You don't have to go to Arkham like all the male
ones. It's like, oh, you've been sneaking into a young girl's dreams and stealing them to make pastries. Just don't do it again. It was just don't do it quite so much. Keep it to one time a week. It's like, really? But this game actually has a consistent villain, the so-called corn stalker, which is exactly what you would think he is. His head is an ear of corn and his body is a corn stalk.
I think the Batman comparison continues to work.
Yeah, that sounds like the kind of whacked out shit that would be on the 60s show.
But the best part of said Cornstalker is that he is a master of disguise and often turns into other things, attempts to steal ancient artifacts that make no sense.
So does he turn into like an elephant with a stalk of corn on his head?
He actually transforms into other characters in the game and then engages you in conversations that are clearly him, but nobody else in the freaking world can put together that this is clearly the villain.
So he's like Don Power.
Meanwhile, he's charming everybody in the game. You're like, all right, that's the Cornstalker. Can we please just do something about this?
The game's intentionally funny, right?
Yeah, it's uproariously funny. The game actually has better writing this time. And the writing was pretty good last time, but in this one... They've introduced a lot of new characters that are amusing. The mayor of town is a turkey, both literally and figuratively. And he's incredibly corrupt and is spending all the town's money on a museum for the town that's completely in devotion to him. It's kind of a shame these games are not terribly difficult to get a hold of, but aren't, you know...
Sounds like it was terribly easy for you to get a hold of.
Well, it was. But, I mean, it's like you could walk into a store and find it. I ordered it online. But it's kind of a shame that these games aren't more in the zeitgeist of the DS collection.
They're the more known, yeah. I mean, you don't hear about them very much.
No, I mean, when they came out, they had sort of a small discussion about them because they looked very different than everything else on the DS. There was sort of an affinity for the old-style point-and-click adventure that was kind of going on. Maybe even a slight renaissance of the genre at that point.
Yeah, I'm not sure how well a lot of those games did, like Broken Sword and stuff. I mean, they tend to get pretty good reviews, but I don't know whether it caught on in the end.
See, these games actually got, at the time they came out, relatively average reviews, which I think is kind of sad because the games themselves are actually really fun to play. I mean, it's hard to review a touch-based point-click adventure game. I mean, yeah. what do you give the controls? I clicked. She went there. 10 out of 10.
Yeah, no, you're right. They are kind of unorthodox games. I mean, they're almost pre-game reviews.
Yeah,
I mean, the heyday was in the 80s, like the late 80s, before game reviews had really developed into the formulaic system that we have now, where you know, you have graphic scores and sound scores and stuff.
In the end, it comes down to how much you enjoyed the game, or the game story, I think. I mean, you can't really objectively break it down into the sum of its parts because, I mean, there's graphics, there's sound, but, I mean, there certainly isn't much in the way of gameplay. I mean, it's one step above a visual novel. I mean, in some cases, it's not that much farther from a visual novel than a whole step. But it's the same situation with those. I mean, how do you review something like that? Yeah. I mean, I picked a text option. The conversation happened. I picked another text option. They talked more. but I actually really found those games to be enjoyable, and I'm kind of disappointed that they haven't done something like Capcom did with the Phoenix Wright games and released them as episodic content on the download service. I mean, I could easily see them selling each mystery on its own as DSiWare. I mean, you get maybe an hour and a half out of each of them, put up there for 300 DSi points. I would think that's reasonable.
That's kind of the system that Telltale uses for their adventure games. But the difference is they have the capability to sell a subscription to the whole season. Whereas, if you put those out on DSiWare, I think what they'd find is that a lot of people would buy the first episode because it's super cheap.
Right.
And that way it's almost like a demo. You can check it out.
Right.
By the time you get to the fifth of five parts of it, very few people have probably stuck with it for that long.
Yeah, I know.
So most people are paying $3 for this, not $15.
Right.
And so the economics don't work out as well.
But I mean, just as a re-release, even if they only sold the first one, they've already made money.
It's additional.
Yeah, I mean, the money's already. Isn't like there's any development costs besides splitting up the two games into five sections each.
And writing it, getting it rated.
The way that Square did it with FF4, The After Years, even though not that great on the whole, the way they did it is kind of clever because you pay your $10 or whatever it is for the first half of the game, and then you play through that and you realize, oh, in order to finish the story, I need to pay another $10 for the second half, and then all these characters have optional side quests, but you can do those and level up the characters, and it makes the end of the game possible to beat, you know, and you get a lot more items and stuff like that. So you end up they sort of trick you into buying a lot of stuff because you get invested in it.
Square Enix is all about that. I mean, go back, they were the first people who had DLC and WiiWare games.
Yeah.
Thank you, my life is a king. Oh, you want to have other races in a game notorious for its races? Nope. $15, please. But yeah, it would be nice if there was some way they could put this game out there for people to try it, because it is fun for... If you like games like Phoenix Wright, you'll like this, because they have a similar sense of humor, although the Touch Detective games are a bit darker in a way.
Well, speaking of games that are in some ways kind of like Phoenix Wright... Greg?
Well, I've been playing Trauma Team for weeks now, and have still yet to finish it, in fact. It's quite a lengthy game.
Yeah, James mentioned that when he first talked about
it. Before we get in depth on that, I should take time to notice that as we record, it is 3DS launch day in Europe. Around about the time we started recording, it went on sale at a number of select retail locations are doing midnight launches for the 3DS in the UK. And so as we've been speaking, there's been some very dedicated Nintendo fans waiting outside in the cold, getting their systems. And if any Street Fighter fans felt a disturbance in the force, it's because Yoshinori Ono is here.
Yes, he is.
Giving out 3DSs or something in London.
And challenging people to duels in the game he made. That was just fair. You just got the system. I made the game. Let's have a duel.
So you've had all these your plucky individuals, you know, doing what they can to take advantage of some lightning last minute deals as well. Like some of the supermarkets went even lower at the very last minute.
Good Lord.
If you went and got it at midnight. I mean, at which point now they, I mean, I didn't think they could go lower, but they are, because they must be selling it at a very substantial loss.
The sales, the prices that they're discounting it to, are those less than, I mean, if you convert it, is it less than the American price, or is it just getting it down closer to the American price?
Well, if you take out the VAT aspect of it, then yes, it is less.
Wow.
But of course, the supermarkets are still having to pass on the VAT to the government, so they are losing money.
Yes.
Yeah. On the hardware, but they're hoping to, you know, undercut everyone, and they make it back on accessories and games and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, some plucky adventurers have managed to do that, but why would I do something like that when I've already got one? That's right. My 3DS showed up a little early. I pre-ordered it early just in case I actually wanted it, and I ended up going with it. And so I have it in my hands right now.
Nice.
I got to play it this afternoon when I got in. My copy of Pilotwings showed up with it, so I've been playing quite a bit of that. Face Raiders, AR stuff. Yeah, haven't had a great amount of time to spend with any of it.
You could be playing it now, but instead you're sitting here talking about it with us.
Well, or you could be John and be playing it now anyway.
And then I'm going to be editing the podcast for a lot of the next 3 days, so yeah. My time with the 3DS is not going to be quite as intense as I would like.
That's, you know, that's probably for the better, actually, because, I mean, you just might burn out on it, because, I mean, you know, it's not like you got 5 games with it. I mean, you got Pilotwings, which by most counts is one of the best launch titles and also quite short.
Yeah, one of the less substantial. So yeah, I'm not in a rush to burn through it, honestly. Mm-hmm. But it's still, you know, whenever you get a new device, you want to sort of test everything out on it. And mm-hmm. I mean, first thing with the 3D effect, I've definitely been more comfortable with it now in my own home than I was when I saw it at the London event last year, up in Millbank Tower. Because, I mean, first of all, just lighting wise, because that was at the top of a very tall building during summertime, there was quite a lot of natural light. And it's not the best in terms of reflections and all that kind of stuff for looking at the 3D, I don't think. Whereas here now, I could find the sweet spot and maintain it pretty well. And it is immersive. Pilotwings looks very, very good. The depth with the when you're looking out across, you know, the landscape of Woohoo Island, you very much get the idea. Although I was interested to read, and this is something, you know, I haven't played enough of the game to assess individually yet, but it was interesting to read that there was a real dichotomy between reviewers. Like, although the reviews have been very compact, you know, if you like, across the board, like everyone seems to have a similar opinion of the game in general, but it was sort of divided into two camps. Like, some people said, oh, this is the 3DS game where it actually helps the gameplay, because, you know, you can better judge your character's position relative to the circles you're flying through or the landing pad.
That's a placebo effect, I believe.
But then on the other hand, you have someone like Chris Kohler who said it does not help at all.
Yeah.
Basically, for the tricky stuff. So I have not played it very enough to say yet. The one thing I will say just from my little time with it is playing the rocket pack, it felt quite a bit easier to judge the landing than it did with Pilotwings 64, for instance. I messed around a little bit with Pilotwings 64 a few weeks ago. Just got my old cartridge out, popped it in. I probably hadn't touched that game since the 90s, so it was kind of trippy. But you felt like you weren't guessing as much compared to that, you know, because you're trying to hit that innermost circle of the sort of bullseye. It did seem like it helped a little bit there, but I don't know. Well, time will tell on that one. But I thought it was a really interesting. It seems like quite a, you know, crucial kind of difference in a way for people to disagree about so starkly. But in terms of the rest of the game that I've observed so far, I mean, obviously, it's the Woohoo Island and it's got Miis and stuff, so it doesn't have much of its own identity, except for the music is distinctly Pilotwings, in my opinion. having gone back to 64 recently, you can definitely hear the same sort of style. I think they got the composer back to do it again.
It's very jazzy, isn't it?
Yeah, there's that kind of jazz element. I think the Hang Glider theme actually has just a little refrain from the N64 Hang Glider theme itself. It's just, it's not the same theme, but it's just a little motif they've sort of lifted and put it in there. And then the plane theme is mysteriously sort of seems to be plagiarizing the Millennial Fair from Chrono Trigger for some reason. But so far my impressions haven't advanced a great deal from where I played it before, when I did really like it, because it controls really nicely. I certainly like the feel of the circle pad, and you know, with Pilot Wings, it's a sort of balance that I think it's always tried to strike, where it needs to feel kind of satisfying, but at the same time, you know, it's not simulation kind of controls. It's funny, if you cast your mind back to Pilot Wings 64 Paradigm, the people that made it, there was a lot of, in the magazines that I was reading at the time, it was kind of hyping up the fact that Paradigm actually made flight simulators for the military or something. Yeah. That was like their background. And you're like, Christ, what is this Pilot Wings going to be like? And then, of course, you get it, and it's, you know, people with Village People tashes running around weird versions of America, blowing up giant metal versions of themselves in a gyrocopter. You know, it is not a simulation game.
Yeah, there's a bird suit in 64, isn't
there? There is a Birdman kind of free flight thing in there.
I was thinking when I played, so 3DS demo units are out in stores, in some stores in America now. And yep. Of course, I mean, the day that this podcast will launch is on the 3DS launch day in America. So everybody, I think, except maybe Australia might...
31st is Australia.
Okay, so they're probably the only major region that that doesn't have it yet by the time you hear this. So I went to Best Buy. I actually went with Evan last week because we heard about it. Actually, someone on our Facebook page posted about it. That's the first I'd heard about it. So I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to go check that out. And sure enough, Best Buy had it. I've been over there twice now to play it, and both times there's been no one there, no wait. It's kind of tucked away.
Yep.
It's facing like the wall. It's not easy to find at all. We actually, Evan and I walked around for a couple of minutes looking for it before we finally found it. And it's not very, you know, I saw other people kind of walk. They were like playing the Wii demo unit and they were playing other stuff. They walked right by the 3DS unit. Didn't seem to have the slightest interest. So I don't know that it's the most eye-catching kiosk.
They probably just think it's a DS.
Yeah, that's the thing. It looks like a DS, even, you know, even like the big blown-up image of it on the kiosk. And
yeah,
I wonder
does.
If Nintendo, I don't know, maybe once the TV commercials hit, it'll be different.
They just need a giant embossed 3 on the closed face of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had to look for mine, too, because actually I had wanted to talk about not just that, but another demo I played while I was there. But I actually saw it behind the equally abandoned PlayStation Move demo kiosk. So they were back to back. I'm like, well, this whole section's been relegated to nothingness, whereas the Kinect one had people at it, obviously.
Well, so the game being demoed at Best Buy, at least, is Pilot Wings Resort.
Yes, it is.
And so I've played it for a fair bit now myself, although I don't think it's the complete game, and they don't let you access the home screen or anything.
Well, you can actually get access to the home screen, apparently, according to some people on the internet, if you hold down the right buttons.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the home button doesn't work.
No, but the game in there is the PAX East demo.
Okay, yeah. So I've played it multiple times now, and I finally figured out what else made it familiar to me, because obviously there's the plane mode in Wii Sports Resort that feels very much like the plane in Pilot Wings Resort, but also the chicken suit, which is, it's only in Wii Fit Plus, it's not in Wii Fit, but it's in Wii Fit Plus, and it is my favorite thing about Wii Fit Plus, and I've actually spent quite a bit of time playing it, I'm pretty good at it, and that mode feels very much in the vein of Pilot Wings.
Yeah, I got to mess around with the chicken soup thing at a demo event once.
It's really fun.
But I had completely forgotten of its existence. Yeah.
That's only the third most embarrassing thing I've done on the show floor.
Yeah, I think that's probably why I hadn't recalled it, but it's just my memory protecting myself. But I mean, at this point, I can't really go much further on it in terms of how it is, you know, owning it. But I really like the balance of the controls. You know, they feel very responsive, but not, you know, like freakishly responsive, so it doesn't feel like you're handling aircraft. So the fundamentals of the game seem very solid, but we'll see with the content. I mean, the main thing is, yeah, I know it's, you know, under no illusions going into it that it's going to be very light in general. You know, I can get into kind of, you know, perfecting runs and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I bought Yoshi Touch and Go for the, you know, nowhere near full price, but the amount of time I spent playing it would have justified full price because I got bizarrely addicted to that game. But with this, the one thing that I'm encouraged by is just the fact that apparently at the end it does get very tricky. Yes. So I'm looking forward to that, because I certainly think the controls are tight enough that you could have some pretty fiendish stuff designed around them. But other than that, yeah, I've fooled around with, you know, AR stuff.
Have you shown the 3DS to anybody who was unaware of it yet?
No, I haven't had time. But yeah, I guess that's, you know, AR stuff of face raiders is what you would use to show. But I mean, at this point, I've only dabbled with them a little bit myself, and face raiders gets trippy fast.
Yes, it does.
It's so silly that it's fun. And obviously, because you're moving around the system and all that, the 3D effect kind of comes in and out, but it still works to some extent. It's a, like, where like the enemies like break through the barriers of your room, as it were, and then there's like this whole like spacey kind of background stuff like that. That effect does work as long as, you know, you're kind of keeping your head, if you're tracking your head with the system pretty well. But you will get, you know, very obvious points where you're losing the effect and you kind of get ghosting because you know, you're only seeing the one side kind of partially of the parallax barrier screens.
Right.
But it's fun and silly, and I'm sure it'll work nicely to show off. And with the AR stuff, I just went through very quickly and still, like, went through most of the different modes, I think. But you've got almost like using a pool cue to fire bowling balls at a dragon. Well, the dragon is like the final part of it. Up to that point, it's more like mini golf. So that's weird, but kind of fun. And then you've got like target shooting and one that's based on fishing, which starts off very relaxed and then the dragon makes his appearance again.
What is it
again
with AR cards and dragons?
The dragon's like the recurring villain. He's always going to pop up.
He's just out here to ruin your day.
I would love it if you sort of put the card of Kirby down and then had him pop up from the card onto your table or whatever, and then the dragon just came and bit him in half.
I wouldn't like that. I wouldn't like that at all.
So, yeah, I've been fooling around with it and all. It's, in general, it's working for me, the 3D. I'm pleased that, you know, it's not, like, giving me headaches or anything, but, you know, I haven't played it for long enough yet, maybe. So we'll see with that. Yeah, so James, John, you in for Sunday or what?
No, I'm not. Unfortunately, I cannot afford $250 for Portable right now.
Not only am I in, I already have a review assignment on the damn system. On a system
yeah,
I
well,
so,
someone else has got to do something other than Neil, surely.
I get to review Rayman 3D, which is Rayman 2, which will be like the 18th system I've played this fucking game on.
James, here's the good news. Rayman 2, it remains one of the best Ubisoft games ever made. So, if it's a good port...
There are some very bad early impressions of the quality of that port.
Really? This is the second or third Nintendo handheld, I'm not sure, that this game has showed up on.
It's definitely... There's definitely a version on DS that's not that great.
I think there might have been a GBA version when Rayman 2 originally came out.
It would have been a 2D side-scroller.
Yeah, it was. But still, it's still Rayman 2.
Well, if James gets aside Asphalt 3D, I think
I avoided that nonsense.
That's
going
to be like
pass.
What would have happened if they hadn't crossed the streams at the end of Ghostbusters.
I when it came up for... All right, so I think... Four of us are going to have 3DSs at launch in North America, including Neil, who got our review unit. And I definitively know to Asphalt 3D. That is a cell phone game that has been ported to my $250 handheld.
I think the one game of the Ubisoft launch deluge that apparently has merit is the Ghost Recon thing that's a bit like Advance Wars or something.
Yeah, although it does kind of look like a GBA game.
With 3D, yes. But yeah, it's not quite as visually impressive as I was expecting. No. Which is the understatement of my life.
So, from something that I've just been playing for an hour or something for over the past few hours, to Trauma Team, which I've been playing for several hours for the past few weeks, and still haven't finished, as I said earlier. So this is my first Trauma game. The Trauma games have a very odd history in Europe.
Yeah.
We've talked about Radiant Historia, another Atlas game, not getting published here. Well, Atlas obviously doesn't publish stuff in Europe. So the first two Trauma set of games for Wii, so that would be the Second Opinion port of the DS game, mm-hmm. and then the New Blood sequel, those were both handled by Nintendo themselves.
Good choices for them.
Roughly a year after they came out in America. Big, big, chunky delays on those. And so, in fact, I mean, it still hasn't been quite a year since Trauma Team came out in America, so maybe it's not completely hopeless, but it seems pretty bloody hopeless. So I was kind of grateful to have the opportunity to play Trauma Team, courtesy of James via Carly. Actually, this is the same copy of the game that was being played as when James spoke about it several months ago on the show now. But the thing was, it was that every time that one of those would come out here, it was like another one was on the horizon. So it was kind of like, well, no, I should wait for that, because that'll
really
probably
take the
be better.
Piss out of it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so
not a strong marketing campaign. Hey, this game's kind of already worse than the one that's already out in North America, but it's okay.
And Trauma Team really builds a hell of a lot on the content of the previous games, because you've got
It's a radical expansion.
You've still got the kind of, I guess, the standard surgeries with this sort of unnamed surgeon in this.
He's
sort
got
of
a number.
I refer to him as Dr. Louis the 14th, because he inexplicably starts the game in an iron mask.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've no idea what that is about at all.
They do explain at the very end of the game, but they don't.
Oh, God, am I that close to that?
it's a bullshit explanation if there's ever been a bullshit explanation. It's latent levels of bullshit.
I probably would have died from a heart attack if it was a good explanation, because it doesn't seem like
well,
there could be
It's
one.
Pretty hard to explain well why somebody has to wear an iron mask when they're already in prison.
In a refrigerated prison, yes.
It's
so
awful.
You've got that kind of standard gameplay. Then you've got various other medical disciplines like endoscopy, which involves thrusting the Wii remote forward through people's digestive tracts, which works better than you would think.
Yeah,
it does,
but
actually.
It never feels quite right. And that my main problem with endoscopy is that it's just too complicated.
It is complicated. I mean, I found it to be a bit fiddly, like, because, you know, when you're selecting the different instruments from the wheel with the analog stick, like, what you kind of have to do is, like, press the C button on the nunchuck to bring up the wheel, and then select which one you want to do. But then before you start using that instrument, you have to click the C button again to disappear the wheel.
Right.
Otherwise, you'll just start picking stuff again.
Right.
So when you're trying to do stuff in a hurry, which becomes more and more important as the operations become more challenging, it's like, click, 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 click. You know, it's very kind of, you do get more skilled at it, but it just seems a bit more fiddly than it probably should be. But that I still, for variety's sake and the fact that it's certainly solid in execution, I didn't mind that mode.
It looks cool, too.
I very much like the orthopedics one.
Yeah, those are actually my second favorite part of the game.
Because they involve quite a lot of skill. There's timing elements to them in terms of like placing screws and they actually keep introducing new elements right deep into the game. Mm-hmm. You have new elements like where you're cutting out synthetic bone and like these fragments just appear all of a sudden and you have to make sure they don't touch your laser as you're cutting, otherwise that counts as a mistake, or the guideline starts becoming intermittent and things like, but very much more gamey kind of stuff. It's difficult to kind of justify the whole medicine construct, but I really like those missions. In fact, it's a bit again where the motion control's surprisingly effective, like where you got the nunchuck and you have to like line up where you're going to chisel into a bone tumor, and that you would think like motion control nunchuck. Let me run away from that. But it works really well. And that's a cool new orthopedic technique that comes in very near the end, seemingly. So, I mean, the content is there. They keep delivering it. But then there's the two completely different sort of adventure modes involving diagnostics and the medical examiner stuff.
Yes.
The medical examiner, I had really mixed feelings about.
it's kind of skeevy, to be honest.
First of all, I mean, it probably would be, for me, better suited to a portable trauma game, because
they're long. They're really long.
It's just like, if I've got a certain amount of time to spend in front of the telly playing a console game, that sort of thing would not generally be what I choose. But I wanted to do everything. I wanted to kind of do it in the same, you know, chronological order of the narrative. And so I wanted to maintain the variety of the different gameplay styles. So I didn't really mind, but that was one thing. But when I was playing it, it reminded me of something. And I couldn't place what it was that it reminded me of. Like, I've done stuff like this before once, but I haven't played any Phoenix Wright games or anything like that. So what is it? And I remember, this is probably a reference that no one will get, but when I was a kid, there was this PBS-BBC joint show called Ghostwriter.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah, I remember that show.
And they solved mysteries with the help of a ghost that could only communicate by rearranging letters.
Yeah.
Lazy bastard.
When we were in school, they would show us an episode, and then we'd have these, like, exercises to go through. And, like, you'd get little quizzes on it. So it'd be like, okay, so Ghostwriter knew that this happened in the case because of blank. And then you had to have proven that you were watching it and paying attention and not screwing around by actually, you know, picking the right answer as to how he knew that. And that's pretty much what you're doing here. It's kind of like a reading comprehension kind of test a lot of the time, although, you know, involving like a lot of medical terms or your forensics terms.
And that one is particularly grisly. The one I played through last night involved clawing at a door until your fingernails broke off.
You have to admire, to be honest. I mean, I have mixed feelings about the narrative in general, but you have to admire some of the subject matters that are broached here are ones that are pretty much not broached in any video games that I've ever played. In terms of domestic abuse, mental illness, suicide. You know, this just
it's
the
really
kind of things.
Considering the game looks like a comic book, it's really dark. I mean,
it's incredibly
dark. I think it's only rated T for teen, but
yeah,
you get into some of these missions, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe.
Yeah, the door is one of the darkest things I've ever
seen.
Well,
you know, content aside, it has to have boobs if it's going to be, you know, rated M, right?
Well, there are boobs in Trauma Team, let me tell you.
There are boobs.
Oh, yes. But, you know, I think it's interesting, and I'm glad that they went in that direction, because the thing about the Trauma Center games is that from the very beginning, they got away with showing these very kind of gnarly, grisly operations by making the graphics sort of neon-colored, very non-specific. I mean, even when they show a specific organ, like, say, the liver, it doesn't really look like a liver.
It's, like, colorful and stuff.
Yeah. So, and the blood never appears except as basically like a cloud, which is part of how they keep the T rating, because the ESRB has serious issues with liquid blood, but apparently gaseous blood is totally you can have as much gaseous blood as you want. I wrote about that in EGM, but I think in Trauma Team, they kind of use the same thing with the story, in that they realize that because their characters are done in this cartoon, anime, manga style, and they never really show violence. They can talk about violence, but they never show it. They don't really curse. I think they can kind of get away with a lot in terms of the themes of the story, and they do for the first time in this game. They really get away with a lot.
Dr. House in this game curses quite a bit.
There's a lot of, it's more your Jack Bauer style curses.
Yeah, like, damn it.
But, you know, it's like, I think the other thing about Trauma Team is that, at least where I am in the story, and I don't know how far along I am, I've played like maybe 4 missions in each character.
Oh, you still got a long ass way to go.
Sure, which is great. I mean, I love the game anyway. It's been sitting there for months, neglected, and I finally picked it back up in anticipation of this. And I'm still amazed by it. I think it's great, and I'm a big fan of the whole series anyway. But in all the previous Trauma Center games, the stories always very quickly take this sci-fi turn, and it's always very focused on the guilt or whatever they're calling it. It feels like you're fighting these aliens. And in this game, so far, the surgeries are much more grounded in reality. And because there's a variety of them also, and they're not all focused on this one crazy sci-fi virus thing, it feels like they're getting more into the actual kinds of topics that you get on ER and House and whatever.
Well, it, it, I mean, there is some sci-fi stuff towards the end.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it didn't go there eventually.
It culminates, but, well, because it has to escalate, obviously.
Right, and it has to get to the point where everybody's freaking out.
Sure, but in general, I mean, the other Trauma Center games have been about, you know, right from the very beginning, your character
Day
has
one,
this magical
aliens.
Ability, and you do like three...
Day fucking one, aliens.
Yeah, basically, like, you do... I remember there was one of the games where it felt like I did about three normal surgeries, and then the virus hit, and that's all I did for the rest of the game was kill this damn crazy, morphing, mutating sci-fi virus.
And in this game, the virus tends to cause medical complications, and that's what you're addressing. I mean, ultimately...
Yeah, it's like the metavirus, isn't it? It causes everything else.
Yeah, and everything else. And a lot of times, you'll see patients come back, which is kind of cool. So you'll see one doctor deal with the patient one way, then another doctor have to deal with them another way,
mm-hmm.
ultimately culminating in the fact that they are patient number 641 of Ultra Death Virus. But, like, the Dr. House ripoff, because, I mean, he is like...
He's not that like House.
He does the same stuff, and he's just about as surly.
The gameplay of that part is kind of like... If you were playing as Dr. House, except you actually had to deal with the details, I mean, right. like looking at charts and comparing numbers to find which ones are abnormal, it's not really that fun.
it's like, oh, okay, assistants.
This is why they cut all that shit out on the TV show, because nobody wants to see this.
I actually kind of enjoyed those segments, though, because I'd sit there and go, well, that's not right.
They feel very realistic. It's like, this is what, like, a family doctor, like a family practice, this is what they do all day, is stare at these lab reports, and they look at the x-rays, and they look for abnormalities. Like, it's very realistic feeling, but it's also not that much fun.
See, I kind of enjoyed, though, because it was slowly moving all the extraneous information until you got down to the core details mm-hmm. and identified what is the real problem.
Yeah, I mean, I was all right with that one. I mean, I guess the only thing I would say is maybe, you know, when you combine that and the forensics part,
yes.
you know, maybe in percentage terms, it's a little more of the game than I would like.
They just take a lot longer than the surgeries.
I was still able to enjoy them.
Yeah, I think the primary difference between them is the other modes are all very hectic, and there's no real...
Especially the emergency response stuff.
Oh, it's too hectic.
I mean, once you get later on, it gets very, very hectic.
Right, because you'll have five patients sitting there.
And I discovered that apparently
you.
Being really bad at putting people's dislocated extremities back in place, it kills them instantly.
It does. That shit is hard.
The stakes are high.
That's right. Your arm's out of socket? Well, I'm about to kill you.
So how the hell did Jim Harbaugh survive to become the head coach of the 49ers?
I don't know. He's obviously superhuman.
In my experience, you don't need anyone to help you with a dislocated extremity because it's so painful, your response... I mean, it's just an instinct. You will reset it yourself immediately.
Yeah, but usually their other arm's broken in five places and their rib cage is exposed.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, shoot me now.
But, I mean, the thing about that mode is it's probably the most hectic mode in the game because you have to keep other patients alive while you're trying
yeah,
to fix one.
You're juggling vitals. Yeah. But you can't just juggle vitals.
You have to make
you have
progress.
To make certain amount of progress in what's actually... You know, their wounds or whatever, and then still juggle the vitals at the same time.
And just letting the wounds fester makes them worse.
Yeah, because then the vitals will go down at a higher rate.
Right.
So that's how you make progress, really, is if you treat wounds, then that'll slow down the sort of decaying vitals, and then it gives you more time to juggle everyone else's.
I would enjoy that mode more if the character wasn't so horrible. And
yes.
incredibly annoying.
I kind of enjoy the Maria character because because she's so freaking absurd. I mean,
that's the thing with the narrative. It's a couple of things because for me, as I say, it is admirable. Not just that they're getting away with it. Oh, it's very mature and all. But you know, I mean, it's just grim topics. You know, that you don't see dealt with in games very much. So it's kind of admirable to see them dealt with. But on the other hand, in the context of some of these utterly ridiculous. Characters.
Maria Torres, yeah.
Just screaming, like, shrill messiah complex in your face.
she has the best messiah complex
the,
in games
the orthopedic
ever.
Surgeon is a superhero,
yes.
right?
at least he's not an asshole. He's, like, a likable person. She's just a jerk.
Tomoe, every
she's
other
a
word
ninja.
Is...
What the
every other word is about honor. It's just, yeah.
But that's Trauma Center. It's always been about that, the weird juggling of, like, totally absurd characters with very serious topics.
See, the thing about those modes, though, as we were discussing them, is that they actually make the rest of the game more stressful. Like, if you...
Yeah, it's so different. It's like, okay, it's on now, you know, and... I mean, some of them, because you could use the magic stabilizer all the time.
Right.
They don't necessarily feel that stressful, like, which is why, you know, the emergency response is so much more. But yeah, right. I mean, towards the end, they do. I mean, I remember when you talked about this, James, you mentioned that you played it standing up.
Yes.
Which is ridiculous. Like, I mean, first of all, because some of the operations start to go on for a long time.
Yes, 15, 20 minutes.
So, I mean, just fatigue. But I mean, the way I always play pointer-based games with my hand resting on my thigh. So I'm not extending it, so it's not going to get tired, but it also steadies my hand, so I'm not going to have the pointer jittering all over the place. So the thought of playing this game without that support is just unfathomable
for me,
to me.
I can't sit in a... Like, I've been watching, you know, my university go through the NCAA tournament right now. I can't sit when I get nervous like that. I stand. It just happens. And those
I get like that with sports, not games.
Those games make you so nervous that I end up standing almost immediately.
Well, maybe our listeners can chime in and let us know about the video games that they prefer playing standing up or that they have to play standing up.
Yeah, I don't even know I'm doing it. It just happens. I'm just standing. I'm like, well. To going back to the discussion of how weird this game can be, though.
Trauma Team, you mean?
Yeah. There's only one character in the entire game that's not a complete crazy person. Think about that. There's a cast of, what is it, six characters?
Yeah, six main characters.
Yeah, and only Cunningham is reasonably sane.
They're seeing visions. They've got psychic powers. One of them has a butler.
Yeah, a ninja butler.
So weird.
A ninja
the
butler.
Custom ornate endoscope.
Trauma Team is a brilliant game. I mean, I would highly recommend it to our listeners.
Yeah, it's really good. I'm sorry to rub it in for our European listeners who can't play it.
I think the it almost had to be silly because of how freaking serious some of the stuff is.
Yeah.
Especially the Kimishima and Cunningham sections. Those are really, really hard sometimes.
I think if you're into Phoenix Wright, then this game is worth getting just for those parts because they,
yeah.
I mean, as we said, they make up a disproportionate portion of the game anyway, and they're really good. I think the medical examination stuff is just as good as Phoenix Wright. I really do. It's very impressive.
And the voice work as well is admirable. I
yes,
mean, obviously,
it's good.
Sometimes the script is, you know, wacky in some of these ways
Maria.
We've described. So it's kind of hard to deliver those lines well. I wouldn't really pin that on the voice acting.
But they try.
And of course, Dr. Louis the 14th is played by the ubiquitous Nolan North, I noticed.
Oh, really?
I always recognize his voice, even when it's different. Like when he's in the weird bits of Assassin's Creed 2 where you're piecing together the clips of Adam and Eve running in naked or whatever the hell that is. And when he's that weird...
I made the right call skipping that game.
He's the weird robot helper guy in Ratchet & Clank, Future, Kraken Time. Like he does have range as a voice actor, but he's always recognizable.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these characters all had recognizable voice actors in some way. Or at least I've heard them before.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, I don't know their name, but at least I've heard them.
Yeah, I think the voice acting's surprisingly good.
It's interesting because, I mean, where the hell do they go from here? Because they made a bunch of games in a tight period of time that were pretty much the same on DS and Wii, and then went completely mad and just blew it up to huge proportions in a bunch of different directions. I have no idea what you do.
I think, actually, I think the Trauma Center or Trauma Team series would work really well on 3DS. I mean, it started as a DS game with the original Trauma Center, but I think the 3D effect would look very cool in these surgeries.
Yeah, but the problem is the touchscreen is 2D.
No, and it's just a presentation.
But in terms of you wouldn't be like directly touching it anymore, but it could still work.
Yeah, I mean, it would be ideal if both were 3D, then you could really work on it there.
Yeah. But the motion, even the motion comic stuff for the story would look fantastic on the 3D screen.
Oh, I'm no disagreement, but unfortunately they wouldn't be able to use the 3D for gameplay as much as would be cool.
You're probably right.
Which is sad.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got to wrap up new business.
He's so gone long.
We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back soon with your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, we start off with 20 years of Street Fighter II. Pedro has an in-depth feature that walks you through the history of Capcom's beloved fighting game. And my week and a half with 3DS. If you're still not sure about the system, or you're just waiting for the eShop to launch like me, Neil has a broad overview of the system's features and built-in applications. He's been putting up one page of the feature every day, focusing on different aspects of the system. There's a wealth of information there.
All right, and on the blog front, we have Power A's Pokemon Black and White Accessories. Zach writes a blog post here full of photos and descriptions of this premium accessory pack for your 3DS. 2DS.
No, that's for your 2DS.
For your 2DS. Nice job, John. Yeah. But actually, it's not just one accessory pack, because Power A sent us like 10 accessory packs for Pokemon Black and White.
Yeah.
John has the Pokemon Black and White briefcase.
Yes, it is the size of a briefcase. That thing, I think you could shoot it, and I don't think your DS would actually get damaged.
If you put the XL on there, it actually begins to assume gravity.
All right, and the other blog, Carly, with a blog called Tepig in New York. She blogs about her trip to the Nintendo World Store in New York City and reveals how she is obsessed with a plush doll named Tepig.
It's T-Pig.
T-Pig.
It's a Tepig named T-Pig for reasons I don't understand.
It's not worth going
and
into.
I still liked it better when it was Hercules in New York.
It's the Pokemon people.
We have a review from Josh for Soccer Bashy. It's this brick-breaking WiiWare game.
Of course.
Of course. I mean, how can you not have a WiiWare game where you're not breaking blocks? But it has nothing to do with soccer or whatever the hell Bashy is. We also have the first of Neil's 3DS reviews for LEGO Star Wars 3D. It's a launch game. He addresses whether the, quote, LEGO hijinks are still as funny when applied to the Clone Wars TV show.
Continuing Neil's succession of 3DS reviews, we have Super Street Fighter 4 3D Edition, in which Neil takes on the highly anticipated 3DS version of Street Fighter and tells us just how well it plays online. And next up, it's Pilot Wings Resort. Again, Neil takes on this long-awaited revival of the Pilot Wings franchise. We also have reviews of Madden, Face Raiders, and other 3DS launch titles. So be sure to check the site all week long for the latest 3DS coverage.
So if you can't tell, Neil got a big package of 3DS last week, and he has been in the process of processing it.
He is burning through those reviews. I'm impressed. He's really been on the ball with that, and I'm sure by the time you hear this, there will be even more 3DS reviews up there. So if you're still not sure which launch games to pick up, definitely go check out the site. There's tons of stuff going up all the time. You really don't want to miss it. Welcome back to the show. It's time for your listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Brandon is first up. He writes, "Hey guys, I was just wondering how you all felt about playing multiple games simultaneously. I recently picked up two copies of Radiant Historia to make a buck or two, but after..."
You asshole.
I love it. "But after a mediocre selling of the first copy, I'm left with the second on my desk. In any other situation, I'd play it immediately, but I just started on Pokemon White and wouldn't want to spoil the experience of either. Do you guys have a preference when it comes to the situation? Does the genre factor in, or time?"
Always time. Always time.
John prefers to play no games at a time.
I actually agree with the genre thing. I often am juggling multiple games at one time, but I do try to avoid playing, for instance, two RPGs simultaneously because I just can't keep it all together.
I tend to avoid RPGs.
I also don't
entirely.
Like playing multiple games on the same system at the same time, mainly because I hate switching discs.
There's an obvious partition between portables and consoles because, you know, if I'm playing Professor Layton or Picross 3D on the train, you know, that is not in any kind of rivalry for my time playing console. So,
you know,
those can go on at the same time, maybe even be in the same genre, although I'd still be kind of predisposed against that. So I pretty much always got in that set stuff on the go at the same time, but it's in a sort of parallel stream.
Yeah, I mean, I split it up amongst consoles and also genres. Like, I tend to not play, like, say, more than one first-person shooter game at one time, you know, because it gets kind of pointless.
It screws with your head sometimes if there's control differences.
Right, if you're playing two steroid-jacked muscle freaks.
I said before that I had Time Splitters 2 and Metroid Prime at the same Christmas, which strained my right hand's understanding of the C-stick.
Yeah. Well, too, also now with you know, the first-person shooter genre, a lot of it is, you know, taking a certain class of character and building it up over time. You know, you collect experience points. So kind of jumping between first-person shooters, it's kind of pointless. Like, you know, you're actually, like, you know, the more time you invest in it, your character gets better. So you actually
have
more fun
when
you're
playing. I like that he uses first-person shooters as the reasoning for this, not fucking RPGs.
Well, that too. And
John,
MMOs
yeah,
as well.
John, don't you subscribe to like two or three different MMOs at the same time?
No, not right now. The only one I actually subscribe to is World of Warcraft at the moment. And okay. I really don't play that much.
I just remember at one time, it seemed like you were playing two or three MMOs at the same time. I was like, how do you do that?
Yeah, I've cut that down because, I mean, really, it's like anything else. I mean, you spread yourself too thin and you're really not effective. So I'll typically play one MMO. Like, that's kind of, it goes back to the whole genre thing. I kind of decided to just play one kind of RPG-ish game at a time.
James, I would think this is not an issue for you because of the way you play games.
I consume them.
Yeah, you start a game and you finish it as fast as possible, so you don't have time to play them
simultaneously. Well, that's kind of true, but right now, well, not anymore, but when we got this email, I had Touch Detective 2.5 going. I was kind of still flirting with Beautiful Joe Double Trouble. I was trying to hammer out the end of Ruse and its fucking impossibleness, and I was still kind of poking around in Monster Hunter Tri. On top of that, I would still occasionally go in and play games like Toy Soldiers every so often.
Downloadable stuff that's very quick play for, you know, that you go for another bit of Geometry Wars or another bit of Pac-Man or, you know, I mean, those, almost like another stream.
But I might drop 2 hours into Toy Soldiers.
Really?
I absolutely adore that game. And, I mean, it's easily the best World War One game ever. Not a lot of competition for that one. I tend to have one game going on all systems at one time. But I'll burn through them in relatively quick succession. But if you're playing games like I do, where, you know, if you play a game for 5 straight hours, straight on, a lot of times you need to step back and go, what just happened? And usually it's, I just play something else. Yeah. Genre-wise, it doesn't matter, though. I can have two RPGs going at the same time. I had a DS RPG, I don't remember what it was. And the last story going in parallel.
The Last Remnant, you mean?
Yeah.
I find that Gamefly is very disruptive to my game playing because, you know, it's like Netflix in that you get more value out of the service if you don't keep the disc for
churn
very long.
You churn it.
So, yeah, it's a churn. And with Netflix, it's easy because that movie's only 2.5 hours at most. Yeah.
Right.
And I'm going to watch a movie anyway. But with a game, sometimes games take a long time to go through. So I have to sort of determine at every point, am I enjoying this enough that I want to keep playing it? Or should I just go ahead and send it back and get the next thing? And all this is happening, I feel almost guilty playing any other games because I can play those anytime. This rental one I'm paying for, which is it's dumb because I'm paying the same amount every month regardless of how long I keep those games, but it's a psychological effect, and it does tend to take over my game playing habits for however long it's there.
You could make the argument that if you're sending the games back in rapid succession, you're actually getting less time with games for the same amount of money.
Yeah, but the kinds of games that I queue up on Gamefly are the kinds of games that I don't expect to necessarily play all the way through, or they're games that I know are short, because that's why I didn't buy them in the first place, is that I didn't think they looked like a great value.
Ping Pals is a great value.
I doubt anyone has ever game-flied Ping Pals.
I would.
Highly doubt that.
I would if it were available, just so I can say I have Ping Pals in my possession.
I'm pretty sure
now.
The Keep It Now price is, we'll give you a month free credit, just take it.
Yeah, it's like, it's actually take it now.
Take
Please.
It now.
No, they don't give you a return envelope.
All right, so
All right, the next one is from Big Brother Drew, a.k.a. Ragnablade, and he writes, last episode there was a question regarding what to play with a young child, and when Super Smash Bros. Brawl was raised as an option, it was struck down because it was considered to be too competitive for a five-year-old. I'm currently 19, and my youngest sibling is 6, and her name is Nina. I've been trying to get her into games, and I didn't have too much success until Brawl came into the mix. She adores it and wants me to play it with her all the time. A team battle versus two computer opponents is an easy way to get youngsters into Brawl, as you can safeguard them as they improve, and when you win, as you will, they also win. Scribblenauts is also excellent for young children, and it incentivizes strong vocabulary. Already Nina knows the words Charybdis and even Hecatonchire.
I don't know.
I probably just butchered that, though the latter failed to appear. As long as there is a clear path to improvement, kids flourish, and I haven't been as proud of Nina since she read her first chapter of a book to me.
We should, before we answer this, we should preface the fact that that discussion was following on from the email which said that the child didn't like to play competitive games.
Right.
Right. That's not why we dismissed Brawl.
I mean, so obviously you do have, you know, the fact that you can play as a team in Smash Brothers. That's, you know, a very fine point. It's not entirely competitive, but I think compared to Boom Blocks in co-op or, you know, New Super Mario Brothers Wii or something, there's not as many possibilities for teamwork necessarily. But yeah, right. I mean, I think with Smash Brothers, it certainly doesn't surprise me that a child could find that game utterly enchanting because it's sure. So mad, you know, the kids could kind of love the chaos.
Right, it's a bit cartoonish.
It is rated T for T, though.
It is.
I mean, I'm, you know, I'm not sure yes. How responsible Big Brother Drew's been.
There's violence!
Pete suggestively using a backside to throw people off
to
the edge.
To be fair, there are worse ways to be thrown off the edge of things.
Well, at the end, the end of Search for Spark, that's a pretty bad way to go. I've had enough of you.
And then he does the Lion King backflip off the cliff.
Oh, dear God.
Oh, Shatner.
Shatner had a birthday recently. Just a
he
side
did. Point. He's 80 years old.
Unbelievable.
Long live the king.
Damn.
Brawl is kind of a fun game to play with other people, but I've never actually played it with a young child. I mean, all I have are my nieces, and they're kind of... I don't get to see them all that often.
I think my only experience playing Smash Brothers with young children has been well documented.
Yeah, Johnny's an ass.
That was very competitive. Some would say too competitive.
I don't think they had a good time in that matchup.
Like I, you know, I put games like WarioWare in their hands, and they're okay. Because, mm-hmm. Fuck, I don't know what the hell doing half the WarioWare games. I mean, we're on equal footing. If I put something like Smash Brothers in their hands, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do in that game that might take some getting used to, especially...
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's just the fact that, you know, it's basically a couple buttons and all that. I mean, it's way, way more approachable than other fighting games. Mm-hmm. But it is still it's still a fighting game. Like, there's still quite a lot to kind of get around there, especially with like items and all that.
Right.
But I mean, kids have a great capacity to learn because they have to do an awful lot of it, obviously, at that age.
Yes. The madness of that game, like you said, is kind of uniquely suited towards children.
If you look at the modern Saturday morning cartoon lineup, kids are being trained to handle visual chaos as in Brawl. Because, you know, when I was a kid, I watched Gummy Bears on Saturday morning and the Muppet Babies.
Which, by comparison, is barely animated.
Right.
It's like a slideshow now.
It's a lot of anime stuff, and there's some computer-generated stuff, but a lot of the Saturday morning lineup these days is like Yu-Gi-Oh! And, Pokemon. That stuff is hyper-kinetic.
Yeah, I mean, there's shit going on everywhere.
I know I just sound like an old man with that comment, but...
The Saturday morning cartoons have, like, the really obvious moralizing these days?
Yeah. Definitely.
He-Man or Inspector Gadget would tell you what to avoid doing for
knowing
the next
20
years.
Knowing is half the battle, Greg.
Oh, no, it's not that explicit anymore. It's usually just straight up, this is the power of teamwork.
It's quite a bit like Trauma Center, Trauma Team, actually.
Less swearing. There's the 3DS game that Aaron, and we talked about on the show once, Aaron saw, which is the Cartoon Network Punch Time Explosion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they obviously think a Smash Brothers game can appeal to people of a certain age if they're putting a Cartoon Network license on it. I mean, it's probably not like aimed at really, like 5 is probably still younger than their target demographic.
Yeah,
but
I would say 6, 7, you might be pushing into their territory. I mean, some of those Cartoon Network cartoons are actually a little bit insidious, and there's a certain amount of double meaning going on in them.
Communist.
No, not that kind of Insidious.
Oh, but that's the only I was born in the '80s. That's the only kind of Insidious that counts.
Oh, okay. Well, there's subtext humor in some of them that would go over kids' heads for a while.
I do like Big Brother Drew's recommendation of Scribblenauts for this, because the complaints I have about Scribblenauts and that it's very undirected and easily exploitable, etc. I think a child going to be... I mean, the great thing about Scribblenauts is it's amazing. Like, the fact that it works is so mind-blowing. And I think a child will be even more impressed with it. And it is, you know, as edutainment, I think Scribblenauts probably is great.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. I got an email today, today from a friend of mine who has, I think, his son is 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And he has a DS that he has one, and perhaps his son has one. But his son right now is playing Super Scribblenauts. And he says that he loves it because he just sits there and just messes around and just sees what he can create.
Yeah.
Hey, get him Minecraft.
Yeah.
Can't handle Minecraft.
Super Scribblenauts is actually better because you get to throw adjectives in there, which is probably even better for vocabulary building. Yeah. And you can make giant purple dinosaur.
Yeah, and kids are learning vocabulary, so it ties in very nicely with what they're already doing.
It's kind of a visual dictionary in a way, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You just put in the word and you see what comes out of it.
And it's funny.
Right. And yeah, you can put Keyboard Cat in there, and it works, which was a funny joke when the game was shown at E3 2009. Not so much now.
Memes move too quickly, don't they?
Yeah.
It would be amazing if, like, they could have some 3DS game with, like, wireless connectivity. So if you just put internet meme and it just, like, scans YouTube for whatever's the latest one.
The newest one.
Generate.
I generate Numa Numa Boy.
Thank you. Welcome to 1999, John.
Yeah.
I think if I had had Scribblenauts when I was a kid, I would have played it for years.
Mm-hmm.
Really. I mean, I would have just gone crazy for that
game. I played with a Speak and Spell. I probably would have enjoyed Scribblenauts.
Yeah, it's like a Speak and Spell, but it's a game.
Okay, James, can you read the next question, please?
I guess I could be bothered to do so. Pete from Columbus, Ohio writes, "Hi guys, I'm doing a report for school on how Nintendo brought the video games back after the 1982 video game crash, and was wondering if you guys could help point me towards some books on the subject. Anything you could tell me would be of great help." So I actually should dig out my email answers to Pete.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Game Over by David Sheff, which is a fantastic book. That's the first one I would recommend.
Yeah, there's two versions of that. There's the old version and the new version.
Yeah.
Yeah, get the new version.
It just has extra chapters.
Yeah. Oh, he didn't rewrite the chapters of the old version?
No. It just has extra chapters. I mean, it's really an interesting book for anybody, not just game fans.
I was curious if he would recontextualize the stuff he wrote in there. I mean, even the so-called new version isn't exactly new.
No, well... Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, I don't know when it actually... I think it probably...
The second book, I think, came out in 2000-something. So it must cut off before that.
Yeah.
I think it has a few paragraphs about GameCube or something.
Yeah. But, I mean,
not much.
All of the really interesting stuff is all from, you know, the NES days anyways.
Which is obviously what Pete is concerned with.
Right. Yeah. That stuff was really, really interesting.
Well, that book is due for a massive rewrite, given the Wii and DS. I mean,
I don't think so. I mean, it's not a history of Nintendo. It is Game Over is a history of the video game crash, which is what Pete was asking about,
mm-hmm.
and how Nintendo sort of rose from the ashes of that situation. So also there's Chris Kohler's book Power Up, which is, I think it's out of print. It might be hard to find a copy.
Yeah, it's
but
it's tricky.
I do recommend it. My name's on the back cover, so obviously I like it. And the one thing about Power Up, it does go into some weird territory because Chris adapted his master's thesis to a couple of chapters, and he talks about, like, the narrative power of Donkey Kong, which is an interesting premise. I don't know that it really plays out in a satisfying way, but there's also a ton of really interesting historical background about Nintendo.
It's a book written by Chris Kohler.
Yeah, I found it to be kind of a dense read. I mean, certainly more so than Game Over. Game Over is just very briskly paced, and you can cut through it pretty quickly.
Game Over is almost like a John Grisham novel.
Yeah.
Weirdly,
Kohler's book is much more in depth, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. I mean, he obviously knows a hell of a lot, and he's just very, very detail oriented. And also, it's not all one continuous narrative.
It's
either.
It's more for you could use it more referentially.
Yeah.
Have any of us read The First Quarter, Stephen Kent's book?
Yes, I have.
No, which I think was later packaged as the Ultimate History of Video Games or something.
Yeah,
it has two different names
because right
they made it a paperback or something, and they changed the title.
Yeah, it's good. I wouldn't say it's as good as Game Over. Game Over is much better read. But it's good. If you want, it's kind of like if you want something not so much from a strictly Nintendo perspective.
Yeah.
You know, like a more broad overview.
The ultimate history of video games, yes.
Right.
Last edition was 01.
You know, I wonder if the difference there is that Steve Kent has been writing about video games for pretty much that entire time, I think, for the big newspapers, USA Today, etc. Whereas I believe David Sheff was really an outsider and someone sort of suggested the idea to him.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he started doing his research, but he kind of comes at it as he's not necessarily a gamer. He didn't grow up with all this stuff. So it's more objective, maybe.
It's written to inform people who are on the outside looking in.
Right. Very digestible.
The original subtitle of the book is something like How Nintendo Took Over Your Living Room or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Sheff, actually, it's interesting because like my wife has actually read some of Sheff's books, and so she didn't even know that he had written this Game Over book. So it was funny. I'm like, oh, yeah, Game Over by this guy Sheff. And she's like, yeah, I've totally read some of his other books. Why did he write a game book? Like, it was just funny. Like, he's not known for like anything video gaming, period.
He approached it like a journalist.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I would suggest, and this is a little bit more tricky, but I've done it a lot when I'm researching my long delayed Seattle Mariners feature, is if you can go to the Seattle newspaper, they have a meticulous backlog of news stories, and there are a lot of really good Nintendo-based journalism articles from the early 90s that they've got in their backlog that are really informative, and they're interviews with people who were involved in the NES's rise at that time. So, like, yeah. You'll see interviews with, like, Howard Lincoln or Minoru Arakawa.
I think Howard Lincoln is the guy who made the Donkey Kong court case. I mean, he was a lawyer.
Yeah, he was a lawyer,
so
and that's...
I think he was the one who basically got Donkey Kong to be declared in the public domain, or King Kong was declared to be in the public domain. That's all in Game Over anyway, so read
his
the book.
His reward for winning Nintendo that case was being made an executive of the American branch.
It's really interesting stuff. You should, I mean, I would say definitely read Game Over and Power Up, and then from there, if you need more, you might want to check out Stephen Kent's book, and there's probably a couple other ones out there, too. Okay, well, Greg has the last letter.
Jim from Michigan writes, "Every gaming generation brings about trends that become norms and shape what will come in the next generation. What trends from this generation are you excited about going forward, and what trends leave you a bit worried about what comes next? For me, I am worried about the push towards digital distribution because it means I have less say on what I can do with my game purchases, and the push towards multiplayer modes and decrease single player in all games. Well, I am excited about all the different opportunities people have to play the type of games they enjoy. What say you guys?"
I'm excited about the move towards digital distribution so that I don't have to go to stores to buy things. And
I don't have a wall of games just, you know.
I'm actually a bit concerned about that because I don't want to be stuck in a world where I don't own my games or I have to deal with bullshit to move them to other pieces of hardware. At least if I have a disc, it's a fucking disc. I can stick it wherever I want.
I certainly support things like being able to transfer games and things like that. But, you know, we've talked about the scarcity of Radiant Historia. And in the digital distribution world, you don't have people buying multiple copies so they can sell them back on eBay.
Yeah, but in the digital distribution world, if you get another DS, you might have to buy it again.
It's a possibility.
I think one of the things that I'm excited about, and this sort of, you know, certainly overlaps with digital distribution quite strongly, but it's not entirely about that. What you've seen in this gaming generation is just the increasing heterogeneity of games. They are expanding to all different places all at once. You know, you've still got a lot of game designers trying to push the boundaries of, you know, narrative in games, making them more cinematic than ever, you know, all that kind of thing. But on the other hand, you've had a renaissance in arcade-style games, you know, whether it be downloadable or whether it be Nintendo with their side-scrollers on a disc or all these, you know, there was much more of a sense of a kind of unilateral development of games back in, you know, when it's like, okay, well, everyone's doing 3D now and, you know, any anything that was kind of that was 2D, you know, like if Treasure was doing stuff on the Saturn or whatever, it was kind of ghettoized and no one cared.
Right.
Whereas it kind of, at the minute, it feels like gaming can expand in a lot of different places at once. And I really like that. And I think with digital distribution getting bigger in the future, I hope that that will only expand that capacity to develop in many directions at once, because it might bring about more price flexibility, which I think...
Nintendo hate price flexibility.
Yeah, I know they do. But in the past, I feel like there is the stickiness of prices, the fact that like most games cost the same is why you've had a lot of games sort of competing to just be better than each other rather than different from each other. Because it's like, well, if you try something different, but it's like, oh, but people won't pay $50 for that because a $50 game is something that has this, this, and this.
Well, and also the fact that you know that you can actually sell games without having to invest in retail space, without having to go through packaging and all that kind of stuff, which means that a lot of these games that otherwise wouldn't be made because nobody wants to front the money to do all that kind of stuff, they'll just put them on, you know.
So you're decreasing barriers to entry.
Yeah.
Well, and just it's enabled this sort of indie game revolution in that, you know, there's so many more people making their own games now because they know they can actually get them in people's hands and make money on them, whether it's through Steam or, you know, iTunes or even WiiWare and DS.
They'll say WiiWare.
DSiWare. So what's really interesting is I think the number of video games being made is going up and up and up and up and up to the point where you really can't keep up with it anymore. It used to not be that. It used to be if you subscribed to EGM, you probably knew about just about every console game and handheld game coming out.
That was worth its weight in anything, in any measurable good.
Sure. You know, between that and Nintendo Power and maybe Computer Gaming
Nintendo
World.
Nintendo Power, which didn't ignore the Direct because they were being paid not to.
But at this point, there are so many games coming out. Number one, it's kind of hard to keep track of it all. Number two, if you're a multi-platform gamer like us, it's hard to actually play all the things that I want to play. I'm having to raise my standards and filter out more of the stuff that I'm less interested in.
Yeah, I just
that
gave
I
up.
Maybe we know. Would have played.
We I really did. Know. I really did. I mean, you can't keep up with everything anymore. You just can't.
It's part of the maturation of the medium. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm not under the impression that I've seen every worthwhile film.
No, but at this point, I think there are actually now more games coming out than there are films coming out, which is amazing considering they're probably more difficult to make and there are fewer people in the market to play them.
And they take longer to consume in general.
Yes.
If you're counting all the independent films, it's probably not the case.
Foreign films as well, let's not forget.
Sure. By the way, British films are not foreign films. I think the Oscars made that quite clear.
Yeah, I was thinking of foreign language.
Kind of to the point we were discussing earlier, though, about just making things bigger and better and more cinematic. I've kind of hate where the first-person shooter genre has gone completely. Mm. Like, I don't want to play Bald Space Marine or just Bald Marine. But that's pretty much your options right now in the first-person shooter genre.
Whether or not he's terrestrial is incidental to whether you...
But in general, it is a Marine who is bald, and that is your hero. And that's really awful and terrible.
Yeah, I don't know. It really depends. On consoles, it's kind of like that. It's not so much like that on PCs, really. You got stuff like Left 4 Dead and Team Fortress.
Yeah,
but
still, I mean, there even on PC, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of bald Marines on your PC.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know. What else are you going to do with a war game? I mean, I don't really know what else.
There's a lot of ways you can not be a bald Marine.
It's just that, look, it really doesn't matter that much what your character looks like in a first-person shooter because it's first-person. And that's the easiest type of character to create, and
it's not the character though that's the issue. It's just the Me Too-ness of the game design.
Yes, that's different.
The character is just symptomatic of it.
It always happens when you get a genre that takes on this kind of primacy of it. You know, the first person shooters currently have. You had it with side scrollers in the past, or you had it with
3D mascot games.
Right, I mean, one-on-one fighting games with Street Fighter, the aftermath of Street Fighter 2. You know, you just get everyone's competing for the same space, and it turns into this game of one-upmanship and escalation. And it just gets silly.
In the after effects of the Street Fighter 2 situation. You had the Street Fighter 2 proliferation, which really Street Fighter 2 should just be its own genre. You had Mortal Kombat, which nobody would argue is...
Mortal Kombat, Primal Rage, Samurai Showdown, Fatal Fury.
Samurai Showdown has its own things going on. It has...
Oh, good lord. Look, James, the reason it's worse with first-person shooters is because Call of Duty Black Ops is now the highest-selling game of all time in North America, And it, when you're, if you own a game publishing company and you see that kind of money rolling in, you're like, we gotta get some of that. And that's why it's even worse than before.
My point is, if there's trends I don't like, that's one of them. I mean,
yeah, sure.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's not necessarily that new of a trend in that.
No, but it's much worse.
The form that it's taken is new because it's first person shooters, because they've become like, the thing.
Look at JRPGs. JRPGs were all the rage. Why? Yeah. Because they had a couple of games over here that were absolute smash hits, and so everybody made JRPGs.
I'm not concerned about these other genres, though. I'm concerned about this one specific genre that I used to enjoy, but really don't want to play another game like that.
Well, and I suppose if you, I mean, to segue into the other point that Jim talks about, you know, single player, multiplayer, you know, like how many first person shooters that are made with the sort of the top of the line kind of development talent and budget that you'd expect, you know, AAA so called or whatever, you couldn't get a game like that made without multiplayer in it now.
No, you can't.
Even though, so if you want the best talent with the biggest budget making you a single player focused first person shooter, it's tough to actually find that.
Portal 2. I just pre-ordered Portal 2.
Portal 2 is a good example, but they are getting probably crowded out by the success of other games.
Right. And I mean, let's be fair. I mean, with Portal 2, I mean, the first Portal was really just kind of a B-side experiment sort of thing. Like,
right.
Hey, this seems like a cool game. You know, it wasn't really meant to be anything big. It just happened to catch fire.
It was a student project, essentially.
Yeah. My feeling is, if you didn't have the juggernaut that Call of Duty multiplayer has kind of taken on, then you probably would see more games like Portal, or, you know, that
right.
are single player focused AAA first person shooters.
And there was more diversity in the first person shooter genre, even 6 years ago.
I think that's the thing, though. That's never going to go away, in terms of there's always going to be people chasing the same space and what's the biggest money generator du jour. But the thing is, as the game industry grows in both sheer size and diversity underneath that, it's just going to be less of a problem for the person that isn't interested in that, because they're going to be served by all these other avenues. There's less rivalry for development resources and talent when there's just more talent.
Well, that's fine, right. But the point...
Well, but James, I mean, I think you're blowing this out of proportion, because of what Greg just said, because there's more selection now, because the market's so much bigger, you actually have whole different subgenres of first-person shooters coming in under Call of Duty, like GoldenEye and Conduit and Conduit 2 and stuff like
Even
that.
Stuff like Mag.
It's really not much like Call of Duty at all.
No, but those aren't getting the top tier development cycles either.
I don't think you can make GoldenEye a whole lot better than it is.
GoldenEye, at least GoldenEye multiplayer, is pretty heavily leveraged on Call of Duty.
Yeah, but it feels very different. Moving on, a trend that I'm a little concerned about is Japanese RPGs shifting almost entirely to handhelds. Because, not that I have a problem with that, I like having them on handhelds. I also like having them on consoles, and they're almost not even being made on consoles.
It costs too much.
A big portion of the whole Japanese software development industry, though. I mean, obviously JRPGs are very prominently affected because they're
because
such a
Japan
big genre
the
there.
Title.
But it's the whole industry there is getting so portable focused.
Yeah,
there's a number of Japan centric genres that fall into this category too.
Yeah, I think it's with JRPGs. I think the RPG genre is kind of at a crossroads, because I have a feeling that a lot of people that, you know, probably played RPGs in like the 90s or, you know, whatever, they're probably moving over to MMOs. So the single player sprawling RPGs,
not me.
I don't know if they work. Yeah, not you, obviously. I just don't think that there is as much of a market for the single player, you know, Elder Scrolls kind of RPG as there used to be. Or I think that market's kind of shrinking. So for JRPGs,
Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas and Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2 and Dragon Age and Dragon Age 2, these all seem to be doing pretty well. They're just not Japanese, but they're single-player games on the consoles, and they're big-budget games. I think part of the problem is that Final Fantasy VII is this inflection point at which, before Final Fantasy VII, RPGs were often known for their bad graphics. It was the developers put all the money into the story and the length and the scope of the game and building out these worlds and writing all the characters and maybe the music at the most music on Super Nintendo. But once Final Fantasy VII hit, it was like, we got to spend a lot of money on cutscenes and we got to have the cutting edge graphics to the point where, you know, FF13 is like this ridiculously overproduced, insanely beautiful game. It doesn't need to
really
be.
I don't really think JRPGs really evolved much from Final Fantasy VII, really.
I think there's a lot more diversity in the types, in the way they present things, like how they do different, like, there's a lot of diversity in things like combat system where people experimented with stuff, but ultimately there is a certain amount of sameness that defines the genre, but that's what makes things members of the genre as well, in a way. I'm not sure there's a lot you can do with that genre beyond where it is.
I disagree. I mean, I think FF13 is a good example of some weird stuff that you can do in that space. And then Dragon Quest IX is not a great example. I guess
it's not an example at all.
In terms of what it does with wireless
it's
trading.
Fucking Dragon Quest. I mean,
stuff like that.
It is what it is.
Well, it is a big evolution for Dragon Quest, but in the larger scope of the genre, it's not that different. But there are experimental games being done. I think some of the Persona games are very weird. A lot of the games you play, James, are, you know, Radiant Historia is experimental in a lot of ways. So I don't think that's
ways.
A stagnant genre. I just think it's kind of, and it's not that it's dying. It's just that I'd like to be able to select JRPGs on both console and handheld. And I think that choice is going away very quickly.
Yeah.
You know how many RPGs I own on Wii? Zero. None. And that's sad. I mean, I have at least a couple on GameCube, you know. But
I mean, even on PS3, how many JRPGs are there on PS3 that are really, really prominent?
Not that many. It's an industry-wide problem.
Actually, to be honest, the 360 has about as many as anybody. Yeah. Because Microsoft basically came in with the money hats and said, make us this game.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, that's the problem. Obviously, as I said, going back to it, you know, it's just right now, I guess it doesn't seem all that economic to fund JRPG development on consoles in Japan.
Yeah,
right.
You need someone like Microsoft to come along and make it
and
economic.
And pay for Eternal Sonata to look beautiful. I mean, and that's kind of the shame, because those games, which did become sort of the graphics arms race, they can be really pretty. Mm-hmm. And they can look absolutely stunning on these consoles that we have now, but they just don't do it.
The counterexample here will be, we think, Dragon Quest X.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's gone quiet, hasn't it? So it's going to be fascinating.
But the counterexample is Monado and The Last Story.
Yeah.
I mean,
and you can't really say that 10 is actually being made for, you know, on the same scope as something for the 360 or PS3 in terms of cost.
No, but it'll cost a lot more than Dragon Quest IX, I can tell you that.
Well,
so it'll be interesting to see how the sales compare.
That's true, but its cost will be much more in line with like a PS2 game rather than...
I mean, it's going to be a challenge from the point of view. Dragon Quest IX is the best-selling Dragon Quest ever.
Yeah. Right, there's a certain barrier that it's going to have difficulty hitting.
If it is Wii exclusive, it's going to have an awful long hill to climb to be profitable.
Right. Yeah.
Go back to trends, though. I think there's a trend that we, you know, there's a really obvious trend that we haven't talked about in terms of our feelings on it, you know, both now and going forward, is motion controls. Mm. Because now we've reached the point where, you know, it is a trend that encompasses the other platform holders as well. You know, anyone got anything to say about that?
I wanted to avoid it.
I think, I don't have a whole lot nice to say about it, but I will say, as an excuse for motion control, I think it was pushed into the market before the technology was ready. And I think motion control as a principle has a lot going for it. And I think there's a lot of game design space that really hasn't been explored very well at all, and partly because the current technology just doesn't have the fidelity for it. And I'm including Kinect and really Move too. And I think as the generations proceed, if this trend continues, I think we'll see the technology get a lot better. And I think the games for it will get better, and it'll be stuff that we're more interested in, because I think even though Wii is centered around motion control, I still think there are relatively few games on the Wii that are interesting because of their motion controls.
Yeah, well, I think going forward, I think the games that you'll see that really employ it will do so really, really well in a really crazy way, because I feel like sort of, you know, the sheen
the
has gone off of it.
It's come off it.
Yeah, so somebody now, it's instead of just throwing it in there just to say, hey, we have it, there's no need to do that anymore because nobody cares. It's not something new and flashy anymore.
Zelda will be a huge test for that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If Zelda fails, then that trend may go a different direction. But if Zelda's a big success, then it really kind of opens the door for a lot of other franchises from Nintendo and otherwise to take that step and say, what can we do with motion control in our big name titles that couldn't have been done before that's worth doing if we pay
generation, you know, there's been a select number of games that really leverage on the motion controls that I've enjoyed a great deal. Trauma Team, I think I'd put in that, you know, I mean, with the pointer first off, but then also the motion control elements. As I said, they will actually work quite well, and I think it just makes the experience a lot more involving that way.
Yeah, Trauma Center, for the most part, could be done on the PC, I'd say. Maybe not the DS with some of the stuff in Trauma Team requires more control than you really have on the DS, but I think it could almost be done as a PC game with the mouse, but then when it does use gestures, they, as you said, they do actually work really well.
But then on the other hand, you've got where it gets shoehorned in, where it doesn't belong, like with DKC Returns and all that, so, you know, I've kind of been ambivalent about it now, but I'm definitely not too worried about it in the future, because first of all, the point you raised that the tech is going to get, you know, closer to the ambition. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is just that, again, because the industry is getting more diverse and bigger, I don't worry about the idea that everything's going to go motion control. It's just going to eradicate traditional video games or, you know, arcade-style games or FPSs or any of that. I think, you know, it'll probably grow the industry by bringing different people in some cases, and it might be able to improve certain kinds of games that already exist. But there's going to be a market for the other kind of stuff. It's not just going to go away. And, I mean, I guess the only argument you could make of downside would be something like where you see there's obviously a certain amount of rivalry for development resources. So I assume some people would lament the fact that Rare have now been consigned to
within
Kinect
a particular
development.
Company. There is.
Yeah.
So one last trend, maybe we could go out on something positive. For me, that is, I love that the games I grew up with now are being revisited by mainly small developers, indie developers or handheld developers, in some cases the big ones too. But I love the idea that we're now getting revivals of Mega Man. We now have like really good Metroid imitators. You know, when people start to see, hey, Nintendo's not really making 2D Metroid games anymore, we're going to make our own and make them really good. I love the idea that something like Cave Story totally mines my childhood for those kinds of games, but then also says, you know, we know more about video games now than those people did back then, and there's things we can do now in that kind of game that just hadn't been thought of back then. And in some cases, the technology, if you look at Fez, which is this very strange indie game, I think it's for PC, or maybe it's coming to XBLA or something, I don't know, but it's a 2D game. It looks like Cave Story, but then you hit the shoulder buttons on the controller and it spins the world. So you find out that what you're looking at, this flat 2D thing, is actually one side of a cube, basically, that you can spin around. And so you're changing perspective. It's kind of like Super Paper Mario. It's very trippy, and it's a very old school kind of game, and yet they're doing new things with it. Same goes for like Retro Game Challenge. That kind of stuff really couldn't be done back in the 80s because it mines a certain nostalgia and a certain knowledge about what came before, and the game wouldn't work if you didn't have that prior knowledge. So that is a kind of, it's almost a new kind of game because it's so referential to the past. It couldn't have been done before, even though it seems old. And I love that trend. I want to see more and more and more of that kind of stuff. I love it.
Well, also the fact, too, you brought up the term mining, and also the fact that all of these game companies now can mine their back catalogs and actually, you know, give people, you know, they can actually play the old games themselves. All of these, I mean, up to now, I mean, if you wanted to play an old game from your NES, if you didn't have the console and you didn't have, you know, one of the NES games lying around, you weren't going to play it.
Or you do an emulator and play it on your keyboard and it sucks.
And there was much more of a sense in the old days as generations went by that old games just passed into obsolescence. Mm-hmm. You know, they became irrelevant. But now the industry has matured to a point where we can appreciate the history of them. There's retro, there's, you know, everything that builds off it. You know, there's an industry that's matured and self-confident enough to cherish its history rather than say, oh, well, you don't want to think about that. That was bad and primitive and, you know, let's just forget that. You know, so it's all the hallmarks of a maturing industry.
Yeah.
So you can have some concerns, but, you know, because gaming is such a young industry and it still has such a lot of maturation to do, I think there's a lot of good things to look forward to. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's going to wrap up our email section this week. You can send your emails, and actually with the 3DS coming out on the day of this show,
you can listen to us on it.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on the system, your questions and impressions, and what do you think of the launch lineup? What's your favorite built-in feature AR game or whatever? You know, let us know. It is a hot topic right now, so let us know. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can send your email too. Go at it. And of course, you can rate and review us on iTunes. We would really appreciate that. It does help other people find the show and enjoy it just as you are now, hopefully. And you can visit us at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/radiofreenintendo. Lots of good stuff going on there. That's the end of the show, folks. Come back next week. We'll have an announcement about Retroactive and, of course, lots of new games and letters.
Bye-bye.
Later.
I think EVs were an attempt by Nintendo and, you know, Game Freak to make players feel like the creatures have their own unique stats.
They
you know?
Do, though. I mean, each character, each one you catch is going to have slightly different stats than all the other ones. So, I mean, I know people who will catch 4 or 5 of the same Pokemon and then pick the best one.
Yeah, but that's because they understand the EVs. Like, they.
Well, I mean, it's not even the EVs yet. It's just, right at that point, it's just their base stats.
Yeah, but EVs affect how they develop, I guess. Anyway, it's just, I can hear someone playing it right now.
Well, I figured while you guys were talking, I might as well occupy myself with it.
Jesus.
Well, I know, John, you...
This is your new business segment, asshole.
Which has been hijacked by PokéTalk.
Hijacked.
Hijacked by the topic.
You can have some concerns, but, you know, because gaming is such a young industry and it still has such a lot of maturation to do, I think there's a lot of good things to look forward to.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, to go out on a non-positive note, the one thing I would love...
Oh, but we had such a good one there,
we
John.
Did, but that was a perfect ending, but I got to get my dibs in.
Oh, God.
Well, the one thing I'm really sick of, rampant firmware updates for consoles and really rampant game updates.
Well, Call of Duty Black Ops on Wii just got a patch.
Well, yes.
You have
I mean,
to go to the shop channel to download.
Fucking
it.
Ridiculous.
I mean, there's so many. I mean, there's a lot of games
fucking
now.
Ridiculous.
Especially. I mean, the first person shooter you mentioned, Black Ops. The first person shooter genre is notorious for this, where there will be a day zero patch.
Yeah, that shit should never happen. Like where I see this is the fucking ESPN channel on Xbox Live.
Oh. I haven't used it since the college football season ended. I probably won't
What's
until it starts back.
What's funny is I'll watch a game, and then I'll come on to watch another basketball game the next day, and both days I'll have to update.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And I'm like, it's a Sunday. What the fuck did you have done on a Sunday?
Obviously not Christians.
What possible shit could you have felt the need to force an update the next fucking day? Are you kidding me?